So next we're going to hear from Lanya Ross, who is an environmental scientist with the Metropolitan Council, the regional planning agency of the seven-county Twin Cities metro area. She has spent the past decade working on water supply planning issues in the Twin Cities metro area, and she helped to develop the region's first master water supply plan. And that and the groundwater model, Metro Model 2, are what she's going to talk to us about today. So, there you go, Lanya.
Bear with me as I adapt some new technology to slide advance process. I'm very excited to talk about this today and to share with you some of the specifics about what we've been doing in the metropolitan area. And I really get into the work I'm doing and the different projects I get to work on, so I'm going to try to keep it focused today, and I want to specifically just address the background of water supply planning at the Met Council, over a century of water supply change that we've seen in the metro area, and of course how we're using a regional groundwater flow model to anticipate the conditions that we'd like to prevent, and also to help us prioritize research investments, our time and our money. So for a little background, my introduction pointed it out. I work for the Met Council, which is the regional planning agency for the seven-county metro area. And we really began our work in the 60s when we were legislated by the state to do a lot of things related to comprehensive planning, and that included looking into water supply planning. And over the years, we have supported several analyses looking at improving our water supply understanding, including multiple modeling efforts, one of which I'll focus on today. In 2005, we began the work to really put together this big master water supply plan. We were directed by legislation that to do a number of planning activities, including the creation of a master water supply plan. And that same legislation also created a governor-appointed advisory committee representing state agencies, metro counties, municipal communities, and utilities to advise us through that process. The progress on the plan and the plan itself was reported to the legislature. It was put out there for everybody to use, and of course, it was also referenced by Princesa. It's in the state water plan, if you can find some information about it there. The plan was completed in March of 2010 after a very rigorous public review process, and it is now being implemented. The legislation, as I've said, specified the plan content, which generally includes guidance for local water supply systems, an emphasis on conservation, interjurisdictional cooperation, and, of course, long-term sustainability of our water supplies. And it also includes recommendations for water supply decision-making processes and funding. You can find the entire plan on our website. I encourage you to go and look at it. There's several components that make up the plan. I'd like to spotlight what I think is the real meat of the plan, which is guidance for local water supply systems. Each of the metro area's 189 cities and townships was evaluated to identify existing and future water demand. So we kind of tried to lay out there, here's where you are and here's where you plan to go in terms of water supply. The current water supply sources being used in each community and also the available sources, even if they aren't currently being used. Some communities only use one aquifer, for example, but others are available. And we also screened communities to try and identify potential issues that they might encounter should their currently planned water supply system expansion occur. Communities all have plans for how to expand water supplies. If that happens, what will the results be? This evaluation was based primarily on data from the DNR and the Department of Health, specifically information through the Source Water Protection Program and the Water Appropriation Permit Program. And of course, we also did some regional groundwater flow modeling to help us identify potential issues. When issues were identified, the Master Water Supply Plan also does provide some guidance to help tackle those issues. Solutions range from recommendations to develop an alternative source that's not as vulnerable. On the other hand, there's also some information to help to create and implement an adaptive management plan for using that proposed source, which includes guidance for monitoring to see whether or not an impact is occurring, and helping lay out specific actions for what to do if you do see an impact occur. So in this way, we really tried with the Master Water Supply Plan to provide local suppliers, technical professionals, and regulators alike with a common base of information about communities and also a common approach to planning. The information that we use to screen communities comes from several really wonderful state and local resources. And those are all the product of a long tradition of water supply planning that we've had in Minnesota. And I had to throw this in here because it just so happens that this is the 100th anniversary of the Southern Minnesota's first regional water supply assessment. The Geology and Underground Waters of Southern Minnesota was published back in 1911 and is a really fascinating piece of work. So I encourage you, if you haven't looked at it, to just go in and look at it. For the original maps themselves, I think it's a really neat thing to look at. 100 years ago, water planners in Minnesota had a very clear understanding of the changes to come and the need to develop water supplies that would support them. The information that they collected and the goals that they defined have given us all a strong understanding, conceptually, of our water supply sources and also the practical advice needed to access larger amounts of better quality water than ever before. And over the century that followed, water supply developments have supported a population increase of over 400%, from a metro population of 650,000 people to almost 3 million. And at the same time, an increase in industrial water demand of over 500%. At the same time, there has been no significant increase in the price of water, although there has been clear evidence that aquifer decline exists, that supply may be dwindling. I think one really interesting example to me in terms of the type of changes we've experienced is that even in 1911, it was noted that wells drilled in the Jordan Sandstone in South St. Paul yielded artesian supplies, but only on Sundays. They were already seeing the effects of that daily industrial pumping on the artesian conditions. And that, of course, has just continued through today. I suppose that from one perspective, we could say we've been successful. We've met the 1911 report recommendation that, and I quote, "No water should be allowed to run to waste, as this will inevitably deplete the supply." That was, I think, a product of their understanding that when you have these artesian conditions and water is allowed to just flow across the surface into streams, it's being wasted. It's not serving the human water supply. 100 years later, though, our definition of successful water supply has clearly changed. We've broadened our definition to include things such as ecosystem services that do support us, although not in the ways that I think was originally envisioned 100 years ago. Our previous work to prevent waste, diverting water to more useful public health and safety and economic purposes, leaves us now unbalanced in our water budgeting. What does this mean going forward? Of course, the purpose of our master water supply planning effort was to look at that question. If we continue to build our water supply systems based on the advice developed a century ago, where will that take us? I love working at the council because we have a huge wealth of information created to predict the future of the metropolitan area. Working closely with communities, we have developed a regional comprehensive plan of 2030 land use, and that information also helps to inform our perspective of even beyond that. Like planners 100 years ago, we see some substantial changes happening. The map illustrates in orange where land use will be developing by 2030. To give you a sense of how much area that covers, it's approximately a quarter of the metropolitan area will be actively changing by 2030. Changing land use is expected, of course, to be accompanied by increased population. In our last comprehensive planning cycle, we predicted an increase of 750,000 people by 2030. We've lowered that expectation with the economic slowdown, but we still expect to see a number of people moving into the metro area, and it's not going to be uniform across the area. It will be targeted specifically in a lot of our outer ring suburbs. This is a map of the percentage change, in this case, almost all increase, across the metro. In areas supplied solely by groundwater, many of those outer ring suburbs, our groundwater flow model predicts aquifer declines. And in some cases, they're rather severe. This figure illustrates the water supply condition that we are headed toward if we don't change course. So you can see that we really relied a lot on the Metro Model 2, our regional groundwater flow model. We wanted to have a tool that would help us to look into the future and say, given our current assumptions, given our current actions, where will we go? And so I want to spend some time talking about that model, but this is going to be a one-slide show of what the model actually is, so bear with me. I'm only going to briefly summarize the model itself. The model files, the technical report, a lot of information is available on our website, and please check that out or catch me afterwards because I want to get into how we use the model. But really quickly, in 2007, we contracted Barr Engineering to construct and calibrate a regional groundwater flow model for the entire metro area. It has been really integral to our water supply planning effort, specifically in allowing us to understand the cumulative impacts of the region's individual water supply decisions, and also in helping us prioritize areas for research and investment. This regional model is a steady state model. It kind of looks at the long-term average conditions and long-term average flow conditions among the region's 9 principal hydrostratigraphic units. Ultimately, the almost 5,000 square mile area was divided into over 600,000 individual grid cells, each 500 meters by 500 meters. And the model includes 33 gauged streams and all lakes and wetlands over a third of an acre in size, so any water body larger than half of a grid cell. The primary sources of water into the model is recharge, which we actually estimated separately using a daily soil water balance model. I won't talk about that today, but if you do have questions, catch me after. The primary source of water out of the model is base flow to the major rivers and, of course, pumping, and we use the DNR water appropriation database to look at long-term average pumping conditions. As my last slide illustrated, we use that model to predict aquifer conditions, and it's been an invaluable tool to help us anticipate aquifer conditions under the pressure of proposed water supply expansion. In areas where these changes are not in line with our goals, stakeholders now have early warning that new water supply strategies might be needed to sustain local resources. And in this way, water supply planning and regional planning resources may be targeted. But the value of the metro model is not only in its predictive capability. That's definitely not the only thing we got out of this model. Our understanding of model uncertainty has also been really valuable in our effort and has helped us prioritize our research. So when we talk about model uncertainty, I think one of the images that comes to mind first is the practice of reporting normalized root mean square error, which just gives us a general sense about how well a calibrated model matches up against real-world measurements. So this is just a graph showing you how well our model predicted water levels matched up against the field-measured water levels that were reported in the county well index. Our model has an average error of 4.5%, and rule of thumb generally says if you have under 10%, that's a good value for a regional groundwater flow model. It's kind of just general practice, get us thinking about how well is our model approximating the real world. So where is that mismatch coming from? Some of the mismatch between the model and the real world is because the real world is wrong. I know it's hard to believe, but we did use CWI as our main calibration data set for this model, and we did screen it to remove values that were clearly in error. But even that being said, CWI has some inaccuracy in it. Imprecise water level measurements made at the time the well was drilled. The well location is inaccurate, and so you get an incorrect calculation of water elevation. Seasonal variability. Was that water level measured, in a drought year, very late in the summer season when water levels were lower than average, or in the winter? These kinds of things. Undocumented nearby stressors might have been affecting that water level. These are the kinds of reasons that the real world is wrong. And this is exactly why I love the fact that we are expanding our monitoring well network across the metro area, because these dedicated observation wells provide much better calibration targets. Very specific efforts have been made to reduce these kinds of errors. And I wish we had them available when we did our model. Some of the mismatch is not because the real world is wrong. Some of it is because our model is just a model. It's a simplification, and some uncertainty is introduced in the assumptions that we make to simplify the real world. And that's really challenging to quantify. And so during the development of the Metro Model 2, Barr created and calibrated multiple models for us each one assumed a different level of complexity in the distribution of aquifer properties. So on the very, very simple side, we constructed and calibrated a model that has only 9 aquifer property zones. It assumes that every aquifer in the metropolitan area is completely homogeneous. On the complete opposite end of the spectrum, one of these conceptual models recognized that the quaternary sediments are incredibly diverse and allowed every model cell that represented a glacial sediment to vary independently of the cell next to it. So we had over 10,000 aquifer property zones. And then we had several models in between. The model that we ultimately selected as the Metro Model 2 was one of the models in between. It was neither the simplest nor the most complex, and we chose it because its final calibration achieved the best overall match to the field data, and it balanced for us. It wasn't too simple. It expressed our recognition that there is heterogeneity in our aquifers, but it didn't go too far to the other end where it was sort of unmanageable. And so that is the Metro Model 2 that I talk about. What effect does our conceptual model have on our model predictions? To estimate that, we used the 2050 pumping conditions that we've predicted for water users in the metro, and we put them into every single of these conceptual models and ran them and compared them to each other. So this map illustrates the range in water level the models predicted for the Prairie du Chien aquifer. Basically, the darker the color, the less they agreed. And so you can see that there are certain areas where there's a lot more variability in water level prediction. This type of mapping has really helped us identify areas such as the East Metro, Northern Scott County, and some other areas where we really want to focus more research to improve our predictive capability. Kind of keeping on the theme of model uncertainty, we've identified uncertainty due to the need to improve our calibration data, uncertainty introduced by our model simplifications, our assumptions, but there's also uncertainty in our predictions for what the future looks like. You know, we have a lot of data at the council, we make good predictions, but they're not certain. Some uncertainty exists because we're not exactly sure what the future land use will be. We've worked very closely with communities to develop comprehensive plans through 2030. We have less information beyond that date, and those land use plans do tend to change a little bit. We get several requests from communities for local comprehensive plan amendments every year. They're usually very minor, but they change the picture. So to estimate the model sensitivity to our predictions about development patterns, we ran our base model, Metro Model 2, with a variety of future well locations to see how did that change our predictions. And so you can see the model is not very sensitive to that level of change at the regional scale. Of course, at the local scale, your well location does have impacts for private well interference, local surface water. We recognize all of that, but it's not the main cause of uncertainty in our model predictions. It is an entirely different story when we consider how our predictions are sensitive to our water demand projections. So we ran the Metro Model 2 with 50% more demand than we had originally projected for 2050, just to see what effect we would have. And you can see head declines greater than 10 feet in our water level predictions across pretty much the whole metro area. So the useful lesson that I like to take from this picture is the potential for water demand management strategies, reuse, conservation, to shape our future groundwater flow system. This figure illustrates additional drawdown resulting from increased pumping. On the other hand, the same order of change in the opposite direction is possible if we reduce our pumping. To me, the take-home message is what's really going to affect our aquifer system is how much we pump out of it. This is a no-brainer. I know we all get that, but it's just nice to have that illustration. It just really drives the message home for me. We are in control of our future. So when it comes to management planning, that gives us a lot of option. I just really want to summarize by saying that the Metro Model 2 has been really instrumental in shaping the Metropolitan Council's new Metropolitan Area Water Supply Plan. The predictions made by this modeling exercise have highlighted areas where planned urban growth and traditional water supply expansion may cause unwanted impacts to our aquifers, which, as we know, are connected to a lot of the other resources we rely on, including our surface waters and ties into our economy. These are all tied together. This modeling exercise has illustrated the benefit of additional data collection in areas where our conceptual model uncertainty is most affecting our predictions. And it is also, again, simple message but important. It's helped to illustrate the potential for water demand management to shape our future water supply. And with all of that information in mind, we've been thinking a lot about what this model has told us. This is not the only thing we've been doing. We have been doing a lot of other projects, several activities, including analyzing water supply at the local level. We've done a recent project up in the East Bethel area where they're looking at water supply and wastewater expansion. We have been working to collect additional information to support model improvements. We've got a really interesting project going on right now with the Minnesota Geological Survey to look at chemistry data and aquifer properties across the metro. We are supporting a lot of stakeholder efforts to develop and implement water supply management plans. We have a project with communities in the Seminary Fenn area. We're working with communities in the East Metro area. Of course, we have our Southwest Groundwater Work Group that's still active. Northwest Groundwater Work Group is still active. There's a lot going on, but I'm out of time, so I'm giving you the website. And we do have a lot of information there, and I encourage you to learn more about it and give me a call. Just call the council, and we'd be happy to share more of the details with you. Thanks.
Lanya, there's been a focus here on withdrawal of groundwater and the effects of that over time. The other half of the equation is, what do we do with that water when we're done using it? Particularly with domestic water use, most of that water is still available to us. But the current system uses regional wastewater treatment and moves that water away from where it was pumped and to a regional discharge point. Has anyone considered alternatives or impacts of alternatives?
Yes. The project that I mentioned in East Bethel has kind of approached, been involved with kind of that type of thinking. East Bethel would like to expand. They are in a location that makes it very difficult for them to handle their wastewater treatment and discharge it. Our major systems treat water and then discharge it to the major rivers. They can't do that. So they've had to be creative and have been really looking into what would be involved in treating their wastewater to a very high quality and then re-infiltrating it back into the system, keeping that water in the system and not immediately taking it out of the ground and then immediately sending it down the river. And so that type of reuse is definitely being thought of at the council. We are also, on the other hand, thinking about, are there other users who might benefit from our treated wastewater? So we've got some slow but steady progress at the council to look at how might we reuse our wastewater and get more value out of it and slow it down, keep it in the system longer.
Lanya, in your future scenario, you talked about the impact of water appropriation or water demand. Did you, and you talked a little bit about the land use, but did you use or think about using the how the land use might impact the recharge in
we
the
have
future
not,
scenario?
Yes, we've definitely thought about that. We haven't run that recharge model yet, but we're in the process of doing that. We have just recently taken the 2030 land use maps that we just got from communities as part of their last comprehensive plan process, and we have converted those into files that we can now run with that recharge model. So that is one of the very next steps we're planning to do. I don't have any numbers for you right now, though.
One of the early legislative proposals this year was to take away local government's authority here.
Sorry.
Local government's authority to control appropriations of water. What does that do to your planning? I mean, if the Met Council can't issue permits, then anybody can just drill their own wells. What does that do to your planning effort?
The Met Council doesn't, and I may have misunderstood your question, but the Met Council doesn't issue any permits for water withdrawals. That would all be directly through the...
Local governments have the authority to weigh in on
right.
water appropriation
yes.
permits, and this would obviate any need for public input or local government input. It would just simply allow people to drill their wells. What does that do to your planning process?
I am not entirely sure yet. We've talked about it, but I think because the planning that we're engaged in right now is at such a regional scale, and anytime there, we're really relying on existing just permit records, the records for that in our projections, and for our future predictions of demand, we're not relying on any of the well drilling records exactly. We're using the population numbers, so I think we're sort of bypassing that. Currently, I don't know in detail how we might have to change things.
Hi. Dr. Swackhammer just finished talking about the importance of establishing a water budget throughout the state. And you guys have done a lot of number crunching in this, just in this domain of this model. How confident are you of your grasp on the water budget in this model? You've done a lot of work on it. Do you have any sort of uncertainties that you might come with it? Or how confident would you be able to report a number to Dr. Swackhammer?
I could report a number to Dr. Swackhammer. It would be, I would put some caveats on it. No, that's actually, she was exactly right in targeting that as one of the primary needs that we need to address and put efforts toward. One of the challenges that we did have with this modeling effort was that we conceptually understand the water budget pretty well, but there just is not the data available for us to put hard numbers on it. I mentioned that there are 33 gauge streams in this model. You know, we don't have a really, the way that we gauge our streams doesn't necessarily give us the ability to calculate really well groundwater contribution to those streams. And we don't have a real, we just don't have a really good way to quantify all the ins and outs to do that balancing at a very, or say, accurate, precise way yet. I completely agree with her that we need to really focus more resources in that direction.
And Lanya?